for the people that needed to move, by their initiative. We are a nation that is maybe well prepared to deal with natural hazards. The issue we are facing now is maybe that the planning of town and villages has not taken really into full consideration the natural hazards, like in this part of Iceland that's being affected now. And the issue is, of course, it is very episodic. You mentioned there about things have been quiet in this area for 800 years. So Iceland was settled 1100 years ago by the Vikings, and there were some periods of about 300 years when it was very active in this part of Iceland. But since that has been quiet, and we know also from other parts of the world, when natural hazards do not happen for a long time, we sort of tend to forget about them. And now we have maybe infrastructure of modern society that needs to consider, or we need to consider how to best live in this country.
Freystein Sigmundsson, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
You're very welcome. Thank you for your interest.
Freystein Sigmundsson is a professor at the Nordic Volcanological Center at the University of Iceland's Institute of Earth Sciences in Reykjavik. Read more about Freystein's research and Icelandic volcanism at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Canadian music. musician based in Hamilton, Ontario. Sean wrote and recorded this song for me, along with about a dozen others, back in 1993, accompanied by percussionist Paul Panchasek. Sean passed away in most untimely fashion back in 2019. Thankfully, Paul is still drumming away with Hamilton-based group Trick Bag. I'll link to Trick Bag at greenplanetmonitor.net. Eruptions, ground fissuring, red-hot magma creeping towards town can be a big nuisance, not to mention a deadly hazard. On the other hand, volcanism provides heat and electricity to Iceland's 373,000 people, and also a blue lagoon to bathe in. Near-surface geology also provides an opportunity to store atmospheric carbon for good. There's been lots of talk over the years about carbon storage and capture as a way to fight Earth warming, pumping CO2 into the ground, into porous rock or gas deposits. Climate activists see it as a big scam. How long will that CO2 stay in subsurface deposits before it seeps right back into the atmosphere again? In Iceland and other places where granitic rocks form from magma not far beneath Earth's surface, scientists have been combining CO2 with water, carbonating it, then pumping that water deep down. Slowly, CO2 becomes incorporated into carbonate rock. I spoke about this a few years ago with Peter Kellerman. Kellerman is an earth scientist at Columbia University and a member of Columbia Climate School's Lamont Doherty Earth University. Was there an aha moment, Professor Kellerman, when you were perhaps on your knees examining some formation in Iceland, and you figured that this might actually be possible to...
There was a very good paper written in the late 60s by Ivan Barnes and Jim O'Neill about reaction between surface water and rocks from the Earth's interior that makes solid carbonate minerals. And I knew about that paper. And when I was working on outcrops of the Earth's mantle, mainly in Oman, but also in the western U.S., I would see these carbonate deposits and veins. And at the time, I was interested in the high-temperature history of the rocks, and so I would really run the other way because this low-temperature weathering obliterates the older history of the rocks. And I moved to Columbia University, and I heard Professor Klaus Lochner talking about using these rocks to capture and store CO2, and he said that people had come to the conclusion that it was too slow. And I thought, from the things that I had seen, I could see those carbonate deposits growing in a day, and for a geologist, a day, that's kind of supersonic. So I thought, well, that can't be slow. And we went back and used the carbon-14 dating method to measure the rate at which these deposits are forming, and it's actually very fast. And that's when I resolved to study that process, that natural process, and see if we could accelerate it so it would be fast enough to make a difference.
Okay, so now let's back up. If you can describe for me how exactly this works, how this process of injecting carbon dioxide into the mantle would be carried out.
Right. So we're not proposing to inject carbon dioxide into the mantle. There are many places around the Earth where rocks from the Earth interior, the mantle, have been transported upwards by plate tectonics and exposed by faulting and erosion. And so they're in contact with air and surface water. And in the natural process, when those things come in contact, carbon dioxide is naturally absorbed from the air, and combines with calcium and magnesium in the rocks to form solid carbonate minerals like limestone or marble. And that process happens naturally, and the challenge then would be to accelerate that natural process, perhaps as simple as drilling holes and inducing thermal convection of water through the shallow subsurface within, let's say, a kilometer of the surface. So it's very much in the same way that you might envision a geothermal power plant circulating cold, dense water going down and hot, buoyant water coming up to generate electricity. This is about the same. You'd have cold, CO2-rich water going down and depositing limestone at depth and then returning to the surface.
And there are researchers doing tests now to pump carbon dioxide into basalt offshore.
That's in Iceland, and that's not my project, but there's an experiment called CarbFix. That's quite different. Reykjavik Energy has a big, they produce a lot of CO2. The hot volcanic rocks in Iceland that they use to generate electric power also have a lot of dissolved CO2 in that water. And when the water comes to the surface, that CO2 is dissolved as gas. And so rather than just vent that to the atmosphere, which is what they've always done, Reykjavik Energy decided to take that CO2 and pressurize it and inject it into the subsurface. So that's not carbon capture, but it is storage. And so they're injecting it into a lava flow where it is mineralized and forming limestone, and they showed that it's a pretty small experiment, but they injected 200 tons of CO2, and it was pretty much all lost along the flow path by forming solid minerals, so that when the water gets to their sampling well, there's almost no carbon remaining in it.
Tell me more about your research in Oman.
Well, we've been working for decades. Oman is kind of a wonderful natural laboratory. It's the world's largest piece of oceanic crust and upper mantle has been thrust up onto the Arabian continent there and tilted and eroded into these beautiful canyons. And so you can walk along these canyons and, in essence, descend 20 kilometers into the Earth's interior. And so that's drawn a lot of people who are interested in studying the formation of the ocean crust and processes of lava formation and transport through the Earth's mantle over the years. And then, as I said, we got interested in this low-temperature weathering process there. Right now we have a drilling project going on with about 200 scientists enrolled, and a multi-year project where we're obtaining rock cores and then analyzing them in the laboratory. And that's involving scientists who are interested in a whole range of things, so not only weathering, but the origin and evolution of ocean crust, subsurface, microbial ecosystem, all kinds of things.
And are you experimenting in on actually incorporating carbon dioxide into this formation?
No, not there. Some people in Oman were kind of leery of doing that, so we're continuing to study the natural process of carbon dioxide uptake in the rocks and in the boreholes, but we are not doing any experiments on enhanced carbon storage. Maybe when we finish this phase of drilling and we've satisfied our science goals and everybody's happy, then maybe we'll return to that question. But right now, we promised the Omanis that we wouldn't do any experiments on enhanced capture and storage.
So what is the potential for incorporating enhanced storage of carbon dioxide into uplifted formations of this sort? What sorts of volumes of carbon dioxide or amounts of carbon dioxide could conceivably be stored in this way?
Right. So in Oman alone, the rocks from the Earth's mantle that are within a few kilometers of the surface, and so they're accessible more or less to drilling, could take up about 40 trillion tons of carbon dioxide. So that's about 1,000 years of human output at current rates.
Over what period of time could they do that?
Well, right. So as I was going to say, the capacity is huge, and that's just Oman. So worldwide, it's probably, I don't know, 5 or 10 times that much. But the issue is the rate. The calculations that we've done indicate that you can do about maybe 10,000 tons per well, and it doesn't scale in a particularly elegant way. So if you want to do 1 billion tons, you need a lot of wells. So, for example, if you wanted to do 1 billion tons a year, you would need about as many boreholes as there are currently operating oil boreholes in the United States. And typically when you do the math, any method of carbon dioxide capture and storage scales that way. So let's just, for example, human output might be 40 billion tons a year. If you wanted to do 10% of that by carbon storage, that would be 4 billion tons a year. 4 billion tons a year is about how much oil and gas the fossil fuel industry moves around on the surface of the Earth every year. So the infrastructure to move 4 billion tons of CO2 would look a lot like the infrastructure for transporting oil and gas. It's big. It's huge. And that's kind of unavoidable. So that's why there's nothing conventional about this, and that's why society hasn't really gotten to the point where we're willing to allocate the resources to achieve carbon capture and storage at 1 billion-ton-a-year scale, because it's a daunting prospect. And I would say, in general, people are not yet persuaded at the gut level that it's worthwhile.
And meanwhile, of course, as you've said on a couple of occasions, global emission of CO2 equivalents is something like 40 gigatons a year, and it's going up by about 2% every year.
That's right. It's increasing 2 or 3% a year, keeping pace almost perfectly with total energy consumption globally. And, it is a very, very worrisome prospect. The doubling time for energy consumption throughout the 20th century was about 20 or 30 years. And that's also true for CO2 emissions. And so if that continues, there's every reason to believe that energy consumption will continue to grow at 2 or 3% per year in this century because, of course, hundreds of millions of people still lack refrigeration and, in some cases, electric light. So most developing countries plan to continue to have energy consumption grow. And in turn, that suggests that if we don't change our mode of generating energy, that means that the output of CO2 might be doubling every 30 years or so through this century. If that occurs, then our children will see CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere double. And most climate scientists believe that that would be very damaging, not really sustainable.
So then, Professor Kellerman, how do you frame, given all this, the potential impacts or significance of geoengineering? Would it be fair to refer to advanced carbon capture as kind of a geoengineering project?
Sure. It's pretty benign compared to filling the stratosphere with sulfur dioxide droplets and reflecting sunlight back into space. But there's no doubt about it that the term geoengineering would be an apt description of taking a billion tons of CO2 every year and turning it into rock. So that's where it goes. I think that, I mean, what I tell students these days is that the best thing by far to do is to accelerate the transition to renewable forms of energy. Mainly, I would say solar. It's, by today's standards, an inexhaustible resource. And so we're limited by our ability to store energy over day-night cycles, but also, and most importantly, seasonal cycles. But I would say that the best thing to do is to focus on that energy storage problem and solve it. It looks like that won't be sufficient to maintain the atmosphere at what we might consider to be a sustainable greenhouse gas concentration, so let's say 500 ppm of CO2. But as a geologist, I won't argue whether it's 500 or 600. That's kind of in the noise. So there's a decent chance that the transition to renewable energy, plus minus nuclear power, will not be fast enough, and then we will have overshot sustainable CO2 concentration in the air, and that's when large-scale capture from air and storage would be appropriate.
And I suspect it would be the most appropriate for industries that are, on coastlines, on the...
I think so. I mean, I think that it's much easier to envision the process that we have in mind in a coastal setting, because inshore you might run into problems where you're disrupting fresh water supplies, which you don't want to do, and large-scale conversion of fluid to rock could cause volume changes, kind of frost heaves and things. So it seems to me that starting in a coastal setting and having storage underneath the shallow seafloor is the best way to approach this. But I will say that will immediately engage some concern and opposition among people who are intimately familiar with the costs and benefits in coastal ecosystems. And so we're really facing some hard times ahead where we have to maybe stop rejecting every single technology that has a downside, and instead look at cost-benefit analysis and decide what's the least worst way to respond to greenhouse gases in the atmosphere.
I was going to ask you just a last question. What is the embodied energy, if I can use that phrase, for incorporating carbon dioxide into rock? Is it, I presume that actually involves expenditures of energy.
No. Actually, so as I mentioned, this is a natural weathering process, which said in another way means that the processes that consume CO2 and make solid carbonate minerals are spontaneous reactions. So they're driven, if you like, by chemical potential energy that's inherent in having mantle rocks uplifted and exposed on the surface of the Earth. It's like a giant battery. And that chemical potential is then converted to heat. So crystallizing CO2, you take all the vibrational energy in the gas or the fluid and lock it up in a solid material that evolves heat a little bit. And also, as you take components, CO2 from fluid that's flowing through a rock, and you gradually add mass to the rock and reduce its density, that causes expansion. So that converts the chemical energy into work. And so those are spontaneous expressions of the chemical potential energy that's inherent in this natural weathering system. And that's one of the reasons we think this is a worthwhile process to investigate, because we're using this giant natural battery, if you like. We think that the energy inputs and therefore the cost might be lower than for any other process for capture of CO2 from air.
But to pump gaseous carbon dioxide into that system, does that require energy?
Well, again, as I said, we would start with the assumption we would experiment with the possibility that we could just simply use thermal convection of water through pore space. Again, the natural system, the natural weathering system, isn't taking any energy from humans. And in many places, water circulates by thermal convection through the rocks in the subsurface, carries CO2 down, and the emerging water coming out the other end doesn't have any carbon in it. So no one spent any money or put any energy into that system. And our goal is to emulate that natural process as closely as we can.
Peter Kellerman is Arthur D. Stork Memorial Professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Columbia University in New York City and a member of Columbia Climate School's Lamont Doherty Earth University. Read more about his research at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, read about CarbFix. Since 2014, the Iceland-based group has pumped 100,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide into the ground, turning it into carbonate rock. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. During an explosive eruption, volcanoes spew ash and gases into the stratosphere. Those gases can linger and affect the climate for several years. Rosalie Lopez of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory says generally, volcanic eruptions cause global cooling.
The eruption of Tambora in 1815 that actually cooled the climate so significantly that in Europe, the year 1816 was called the year without a summer.
The cooling is driven by sulfur dioxide in the upper atmosphere, which combines with water molecules to produce sulfuric acid. When that condenses, it forms aerosols that reflect the sun's rays back to space. Lopez says volcanoes also emit carbon dioxide, which increases global warming, but only a relatively small amount, especially compared to human activities.
The 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens released 10 million tons of CO2 into the atmosphere in the first 8 or 9 hours. But that amount is released by humans every 2.5 hours.
So volcanoes are not causing today's global warming. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org. Yep.